Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Jenna Wortham.
Yes, sir.
What do you remember about last Saturday?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I just remember people in the streets of Brooklyn seeming to be so embodied and so carefree. It was almost like if pride and that, you know, every sports finale rolled into one and then just let loose on the streets. What do you remember about Saturday?
I'll never forget anything about that day.
Yeah.
I wasn't one of those people who was glued to the TV to see which guy was going to win. But I'm getting all these euphoric texts from people. But I'm kind of like, all right, well, you know, this is good. I'm just going to go check out the scene. It's very, very loud. So I get down to the pavement and there's this couple coming toward me. And the man and the woman start smiling. And I'm like, don't smile. Do not smile at them.
Why?
And I just didn't want to give in to the euphoria. But I smiled at the two of them. And Jenna, it's like my whole being just cracked open.
Aww.
And I like was laughing hysterically.
What do you think the laughter was about?
I had 4 years of pent up hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
I just walked down Atlantic Avenue and I was just cracking up. People were like, well, I don't know if it's that funny. But everybody was so happy.
Mm.
But I can't describe, it's not happy. I was not happy. I was truly hysterical.
So interesting.
And I'm like, Wesley, to answer your question, Jenna, like, what do I think that was about is the question that I was asking myself. Like, why am I laughing so much? And I think it's because this whole thing is ridiculous. This is all just wildness and lunacy to me.
It was like a spell had broken.
That's it.
It was like everything we talked about last week in terms of trying to find our footing and get grounded and what's up from down. It was kind of like, yes, somebody pressed the gravity button and we fell from the spaceship back to Earth. You know, they were no longer spinning, you know, in movies when they look at the compasses and they're like, the meters are all off. And it's just like, woo, woo, woo. I feel like the compass was working again.
Yeah.
And I felt a sense of sanity. Like I just felt like euphoric. That was euphoric. Wesley, did you join the dancing?
No, I didn't dance.
And I didn't either. And I think part of it is because we have a different grasp on this reality, which is to say that a lot of it is bound up in a fantasy, a series of fantasies. It's not just one fantasy we're talking about, but there's a lot of self-delusion happening around what the last presidency meant and what the next one will mean.
And the one before that?
And the one after that.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing that we put so much on this one job of president. This one job. It's nobody's dancing in the streets for like city council members.
Mm.
Nobody's dancing in streets for like, you know, we got a new comptroller. The mayor doesn't seem to elicit this much joy. It's the one job. Only one job. Nobody, when, you know, Moonlight wins Best Picture, aren't people dancing in the streets? No, it's the president. We have taken this one job and we've invested so much meaning into it. You know, the president's on our money. The president is, you know, there are buildings named after presidents. I don't know what school you went to, but like some school near your school was probably named for a president. And of course, we know the answer to why. It's like, this is the person who's going to run the country. Yeah, we are a country built on a bunch of fantasies. And the question is, how much do we want to acknowledge that we're in one at any given time?
I'm Jenna Wortham.
I'm Wesley Morris. And we're two culture writers at the New York Times. Damn, we're awash in fantasies.
And this is Still Processing. You know, just listening to you talk, Wesley, makes me think a lot about the function of fantasy, right? And you and I have spent a ton of time on this right here very show, past episodes, check them out if you want, you know, talking about the function of science fiction, right? And science fiction being a place where we get to really work out these moral, philosophical, really important questions about society and humanity, because it allows us space to dream and imagine and rebuild worlds within which to work out the solutions to the problems that we see in the real world, right? And when I think about the function of fantasy is that it's essentially just feel good. It's like a feel good mechanism. And fantasy is just whatever you want to make it. And when you think about the role of the presidency through that lens, the last 4 years all of a sudden make a lot of sense. And the, I mean, the country makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. The president brand is strong. It's the number one job, right? When you tell kids, like, you know, you can be anything in the whole world. Nobody stops at, like, bus driver. Nobody stops at, like, head of surgery. Nobody stops at, like, volleyball coach. It's like, president, I'm going to tell my daughter she can do anything she wants. It's the president.
It's like astronaut. President, veterinarian. That's it.
The president is where, like, all of the dreams that you have for your successive generations get rolled into that one job. So a few years ago, Donald Trump decides that he also was going to run for that job. Because you know what? He was raised in this country just like we all were. He believes in the fantasy too.
Why not me? He said one day.
Exactly. But you know what is attached to that? Why not me? He understands that the president brand is strong. He knows that POTUS is bigger than anything that he could possibly be doing with a building.
Oh, God.
So what does he do? He takes the brand of POTUS and basically slaps a T-R-U-M-P on top of it or alongside it and basically rebrands the presidency a Trumpacy or something. And it isn't just that he believed in this fantasy. It's that he also had an idea for a standard of what a president is and should be. And you know who wasn't presidential to him?
Yeah.
The previous office holder. There was something about Barack Obama that, I mean, it's not just for Donald Trump. I mean, lots of people were like, oh God, what's going to happen to the presidency now? Tainted. It's being occupied by this gentleman. But I mean, if you think about the ways in which we so invested not just in the presidency with Obama, but with in Obama himself. Like, we made that man more than the presidency.
I don't even know if we've really reckoned with how much we needed the fantasy of the Obama presidency to tell us a different story about this country, and the fact that we still can't really look back and contend with some of the legacies of his tenure. I remember praying for all 8 years of the Obamas administration that there were going to be no skeletons coming out of these closets. I didn't want no bodies. I didn't want no allegations. You know, I didn't want a stray hair, right? Because we know that the stakes for being Black people in public and in the highest public office, that level of visibility, it's just too easy to find something to latch onto to deem them illegitimate and unworthy, right? Like, there hasn't really been a reckoning with the limits of imagining the Obamas as the embodiment of a post-racial fantasy. We haven't actually dealt with, you know, the fact that Trayvon Martin happened. when Obama was president. You know, that Skip Gates got arrested when Obama was president, that, you know, Obama was still deporting people under ICE as a president. And these are things that are uncomfortable to think about because they don't fit into our fantasy that electing him negated all the racial trauma and stress and issues that this country had. No, that's our fantasy of what would happen when he was elected.
And so now we've got this other guy who is going to step into this fantasy, a guy who has been trying to step into this fantasy for decades and has not quite gotten there. And we don't even know what his fantasy of that fantasy is going to look like. But I'm interested to see how that goes.
I actually think a lot of people are more interested in what the fantasy around Kamala Harris is going to be.
Oh, yeah.
And,
that's true.
You know, I think it's valid, but there's been a lot of excitement about her post and being elected, the first Black woman, first South Asian woman, you know, first woman of color to be elected vice president in this country. Hooray, hurrah. What does this mean? You know, and she even called it out in her speech on Saturday. She was like, I will not be the last, which I did appreciate. But, you know, I think there's a lot of skepticism around the easy narrative around her, right? That it's enough that she was elected and that we don't have to pay attention to her track records as district attorney in San Francisco and attorney general in California. And there's been a lot of really brilliant analysis on what I'll call Black feminist Twitter, academic Twitter, about the limits of what her Blackness can do for someone who has a career that has been really detrimental to a lot of Black lives in terms of upholding wrongful convictions and things like that. And I think that's really fascinating. And I don't know if that's a conversation we could have had 8 years ago. I don't know if it's a conversation we would have wanted to have. I would not have wanted to have that. It's tough, right? Because Kamala is really enduring the weight of the lack of scrutiny during that administration and a desire to not air the dirty laundry too much. But it also feels really encouraging and really exciting that for as much as people want to celebrate her and celebrate this win and let it be a fantasy, there are as many people who are very willing to hold both truths in the same hand, right? That it can be very exciting and it can be very significant to have this woman elected to this post. And at the same time, we have to hold her accountable and really interrogate her about our policies and what they mean for this country. And we all have to be extraordinarily cautious that we don't trade one fantasy for another, right? And that we don't lull ourselves into this idea that just because Biden was elected president, that we can dust our hands off and all is well.
Say that we're done. Yep.
I am not fully convinced that that hasn't happened, right? Like at the end of the festivities of Saturday, I had gone out to dinner with two of my Black girlfriends and we wanted to have dinner, just have a little sushi meal outside safely and watch the speeches, right? We didn't care about old Joe. We wanted to watch Kamala, right? We prop up our iPhone on the bottle of water on the table and we've got it streaming. And suddenly the three of us become aware there's a person standing on the other side of the table, right? Intensely staring at us. Nobody knew who this person was. He starts gyrating his hips and singing the F Donald Trump song while making prolonged eye contact with all three of us. And then he just moseyed along. And I was so angry. That experience, this random ass white person rolling up and thinking they had the right to interrupt us and have this, in their mind, perception of a shared political solidarity moment infuriated me.
But why? I mean, I hear you, but I actually would just like to know why.
Because this random ass white guy rolling up onto our table, doing his little noodle dance and singing the YG song, F Donald Trump. It just felt like solutionism, right? He wanted us to know, hey, I voted for Biden and your problems are over. That's not my experience. That is not the shared experience of any single person at that table. We are three different Black women with three very different lived experiences with different needs. And that ain't it. I was like, we're not done. I mean, right. As Black women, our work will never be done. And the fact that you think it is, you can wrap up that problem in a very neat little package and send it down the conveyor belt because it needs to be refiled. That doesn't make any sense. But what I was trying to say is it worried me because I just wondered, was every single person dancing in Fort Greene in Brooklyn under the same impression? Was there a new spell being cast? Lord help us all. I don't know.
Oh my God, Jenna, yes. It's been being cast since at least 1776. That spell is called America.
Yeah. Oh God.
The spell is America. The fantasy is America. We should talk about this because that is part of the other aspect of what happened on Saturday, is the fantasy of what America is.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Jenna, can I tell you my fantasy of what I think the United States is?
Oh my God, yes.
It's America Land! You just bought a ticket to the fantasy of America Land, where you person in some other country who's maybe oppressed, you can see that there's this country somewhere else in the distance that is beckoning you to come to it to realize your dreams, because it is a land of opportunity. You can do anything. You can be whoever it is that you want to be in America. Make your dreams come true. If not for yourself, then for your children, who someday could be, dun 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 dun, president of the United States of America Land. I mean, it is an amazingly powerful fantasy. And it only requires you to sort of buy into the fantasy as being somehow simultaneously ahistorical, but also very rooted in a particular way of being in this country.
I mean, wasn't this last election about a fight over the fantasy? Like, what is going to be the reigning champion fantasy this country for the next 4 years? It was
who
a fight between...
the fantasy title belt? Yes.
Who gets the fantasy title belt, right, for America? It was a fight between this, you know, one version of the country that's very entrenched in much older ways, with which that I think that side tends to call tradition and heritage. And then there's this other notion of what this country could be, which is more steeped in, I guess, an idea of linear progression, right? This idea of progress, this idea of forward momentum. And both of those ideas are inherently fantasies, because I don't know that either of them are possible to maintain forever, but they're animating principles for this country. Absolutely.
And the fight between progress and tradition is so built into this country that the last time the country sort of fell apart in this major cataclysmic way, it was over this very question. And that was, of course, obviously the Civil War. That was 4 years of combat about this question of you know, what America is, what its values are, and who gets to participate in that fantasy. And it's wild to me that this election in 2020 is asking the same questions in many ways. Trump wants to keep America great. Joe Biden is campaigning for the soul of America. I mean, you couldn't get more stark than that. But Jenna, queen of big questions being answered in meaningful and concise ways. The Civil War being about one version of tradition versus progress versus 2020 being another battle of tradition versus progress. How does this keep happening?
I mean, why does anything continue in a perpetual cycle without it ever changing? Because you don't address it. You don't deal with it. I mean, for there to be any kind of resolution, we would have to acknowledge that we haven't healed from it. And there's this James Baldwin quote that keeps knocking around in my mind, and it's one that's frequently Instagram, so I'm sure people have heard it before. But it's from this Esquire interview in the late 60s. And the country's in turmoil, much like it is today. And the interviewers keep asking James Baldwin, like, what will it take for Black people to cool it? And you can hear the fury in his voice when he finally says, it is not for us to cool it, right? And then he goes on to say, if the American Black man, but we'll just say person because, you know, it's in 2020 and he meant all people, all Black people. But if the American Black person is going to become a free person in this country, then the people of this country have to give something up. You know, and I think a lot about that, right? Like, what would it mean to let go of these fantasies?
I think it would require us to actually do the work. And I think one of the things about the way we traditionally talk about progress versus tradition is that I feel like the directions are wrong. Like, tradition is about anti-change. You want things to just be the way they are or the way they always have been. And progress is about moving forward. But I actually think that the direction we should be trying to go in more frequently is down.
Oh, plumbing inward, the down. So,
right, exactly.
Yes.
When I say going down, I essentially mean like getting to the root causes of these problems. Like, where does the problem come from and how did it get in all these systems? It's because it was sort of planted there from the very beginning. And like pulling up those roots and maybe replanting some things. I mean, I'm not really interested in progress that doesn't also come with reckoning.
Same. But all of that hinges on a total buy-in, right? Like, I don't want to make broad sweeping assumptions about how those 70 million Americans who voted to re-elect Trump feel. But just anecdotally, based on the responses I get on Instagram, I posted a screenshot of a tweet from a person named Summer Lee on my Instagram the other day that basically said, you know what, instead of thanking Black women, why don't you just give us the investments we need, end police violence, commit to building Black political power and reparations. A simple thought, when I tell you I've had to monitor this post for the hateful comments and people saying basically, get a job, your people are lazy. Why would I give you any money? You deserve nothing. You've had so much time to figure this problem out.
Not to get hung up on that, but like, what, like, haven't you figured it out? There is a seat at the table for you when you're ready to help us figure it out. Like, I mean, I don't know what to tell you about that. But at the same time, I think these conversations become increasingly improbable when we can't even agree on like how people might behave in response to a presidential election, which the stores in various cities boarded up preemptively in the days before the election, because for whom? Why? It could be because people were upset about either outcome in this election.
Wasn't the boarding up offensive in some ways because it assumed that the only possible response to this election was going to be violence? And it felt like inciting. It felt like a provocation. It felt like this fantasy that we're heading towards another civil war. And that's the only logical outcome for the future and how absurd that is and how insulting that is. But actually, a lot of people seem to agree, which reminds me of the Purge movies, which I know you've seen all of them, right?
I have seen them all. The Purge is basically, you know, the original Purge, which came out in 2013, is a movie about a political party called the New Founding Fathers of America.
This is not a test. This is your emergency broadcast system announcing the commencement of the annual purge sanctioned by the U.S. government.
They are running the country and they have instituted this policy.
Weapons of class 4 and lower have been authorized for use during the purge.
Whereby 12 hours a year, American citizens are allowed to give in to their wildest, most violent fantasies because there is no law.
Commencing at the siren, any and all crime, including murder, will be legal for 12 continuous hours.
And with no law, people are free to just start killing each other if that's what they want to do.
Well, okay, so I love a bad origin story. So I watched the first Purge. That's the only one I've seen. Because it's the most conspiracy theory one, therefore it's the most relevant to my life. And it essentially reveals that the Purge was created as an experiment on Staten Island to get rid of poor people, right? Like there's this really ridiculous moment with the head of the Founding Fathers Party who's like, you know, we can't afford to support these people. The country's out of money. Like there's not enough to go around. So we're just going to let them kill each other and reduce the population.
This country is overpopulated, doctor. There's too much crime, too much unemployment.
Is that even true? Or did you falsify those numbers?
They can't afford to care for its own citizenry. People don't want us to raise taxes. Our debt is tripled. Can't pay for anything. It's something needed to be done.
Not like this.
What then? You tell me, because we exhausted every possibility.
And it's kind of great because Marissa Tomei plays the scientist whose idea it was to like release this aggression. And she's like, what have I done? And I'm like, wow, very on the nose. A well-meaning white lady basically playing with eugenics in an experiment that gets taken totally out of control at the expense of poor black and brown people. Like America, well done. But you know, the poor people don't take the bait, right? They essentially end up in this housing project helping each other survive. And the government who's instigating all of this mayhem, all of this chaos, which wink, wink, like pay attention, everybody, like sound familiar. But, you know, they underestimate the strength of community. They underestimate the strength of collectivity. They underestimate the strength of collective will and desire to keep fighting for a better world and a quote, better country, which really for them just means bare minimum day-to-day survival. Like the people in this film are not obsessed with this larger redemptive narrative of America. They have no like big fantasies about this country turning around and suddenly working in their favor. They just really want to have the things that they need in life. They want their community, they want their church intact, and they want their kids alive.
Right.
I felt really moved by that actually, you know, that we don't have to play into these fantasies. Like we don't have to participate in these paradigms that are set up for us to participate in. And the only way to fight back is really to not fight each other.
But Jenna, the crazy thing about what happened on Saturday is that was essentially a purge, right?
What do you mean?
I mean, people dancing in the streets, it was a total emotional purge. It was like all of this pressure that had just been like building up and building up and building up and building up. You just like, you're getting it out. As it turns out, what we needed that day wasn't violence. It was relief. And, you know, one thing about these fantasies is that one voter's fantasy is essentially another voter's nightmare. And some of the power of what happened on Saturday was that for some people, they were being released from a nightmare. And it does sort of make me wonder, Jenna, why we even need fantasies in the first place? Why do we need the America Land fantasy? Why do we invest the power of the presidency with this fantasy as though the ambition to preside is the cure for all that ails us? Like, what even is a fantasy?
Yes to all of that. You know, and I was doing a little bit of research last night into the etymology of words like fantasy, dream. And one of the things that came up in my research is that a dream is visionary, right? Dreams are the things that emerge to the subconscious mind when you're sleeping or kind of, you know, not totally aware of them. And they're inspiring and they are motivating and they propel you towards something, right? I mean, they have this origin of like something liberatory and joyful. Mm-hmm. Now, fantasy is kind of like the evil twin of a dream in that a fantasy is kind of an illusion based on desires, right? It's trickery, right? An illusion, because they're so all-consuming and they are more active, right? And that makes them a little bit more powerful. So it's very easy to get swept up in someone else's fantasy, right? And you have to be really careful about the parameters of someone else's imagination and their vision. There are these machinations that you can get subsumed by without even realizing it.
Yeah.
Especially if you don't have any of your own.
Oh, shit. I mean, that's right. That's it. I don't want to be under anybody else's spell.
Right. The speech was not called, I have a fantasy. No, it was called, I have a dream, because dreams are imaginative. They are collectivity in action. They are the future of, you know, something that you want to behold rather than just something that's to your own means or something that you're enacting for your own gain, which is essentially, I think, what a fantasy can be. So, you know, I think, Wesley, the reason you and I couldn't fully give in to the celebrations in Brooklyn on Saturday is that deep down inside both of us, we know that's not the dream. That's a fantasy, right? The fantasy is that a president is going to solve all these countries' problems and that this is where the journey ends. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're both taking away is that we're not trying to get caught up in anyone else's fantasy. We got to have our own dreams. And we got to know the difference between the two.
Still Processing is a product of the New York Times.
It is produced by Hans Buto.
Our editors are Sarah Saracen, Sasha Weiss, and Wendy Dorr.
Our engineer is Marian Lozano.
And the executive producer of NYT Audio is Lisa Tobin.
Our theme music is by Kindness. It is called World Restart from the album Otherness.
And, you know, if you remember, please... leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It's just nice to know how our driving is going.
True. Very true. And this is the end of our season for this year. Thank you for bearing with us through ad hoc emergency quarantine episodes. But we'll be back next year. We'll be a little more stable, a little more regular. We hope, right?
A little. We'll be back on the reg in 2021.
You can set your watch to it.